This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the easiest way to create beautiful blogs and websites and push content to your social networks.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 86, Logic Bombing, the Shakespeare Robot. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the latest on the Best of Both Worlds theatrical event, Star Trek Tunic Tanks, a peek inside DK's visual dictionary, the making of Star Trek, the video game, and our impressions of IDW's ongoing number 18 and Countdown to Darkness number 2. Then in the feature, we're joined by Drew Stewart and Charlene Schmidt to discuss the TOS episode, The Conscience of the King. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I'm doing wonderfully. I just got back from the Seattle Aquarium, where I saw probably the most adorable fur seal you've ever seen. It's not a seal, actually. It's actually a sea lion, but they're called fur seals. It was feeding time. Oh my God, Chris. Is there a good aquarium there in Tokyo?
Actually, yeah, there are several of them, one not too far away from us around in Enoshima. But now, I thought you were going there to swim with the whales. Now, what's this thing? I saw it on the news. It was actually on the news here because it was so shocking. As guy with beard in his underwear swimming in the aquarium in Seattle.
Get in there. What the hell? Excuse me. Wait right here.
My fancy command boxers, yes. I wanted to find out if the fish were pregnant. Turns out most of them were pregnant.
I suppose they've told you that, huh?
It wasn't that big a deal. They're pregnant a lot. But no, I had a good chat with Martha and Janie, Phyllis, Elizabeth, Donna. Sorry. The list goes by. A lot of fish. I talked to a lot of fish. Not a big deal.
Well, you heard it here, everyone. Greg may claim on the Ready Room that he hates Star Trek IV. But he loves it so much that this weekend he went to actually reenact his favorite scenes.
Came all the way down here just to jump in and swim with the kiddies, huh?
I won't lie. I referenced Star Trek IV quite a bit. I was looking for the Cetacean Institute. Yes, I feel bad about it. There were at least 10 real-life Star Trek IV references that I made today, and I feel very bad about it.
Well, you know, I noticed that you had some tickets in your hand the other day that you sent me an image of, and at first I thought they were tickets to the Best of Both Worlds event coming up, but apparently they are tickets into darkness. Is that correct?
Yes, they are. They're the darkest tickets money can buy. They're tickets to the advanced screening of Star Trek Into Darkness that's scheduled for May 15th, which is IMAX 3D, which I did not want to see the film in 3D, but it's 2 days early, so I could not. But when I went to the theater to pick up tickets for another movie, which I believe was called A Die Hard Knock Life, my tickets to Star Trek popped out. I was like, I'm not seeing Star Trek tonight. What's going on?
That's the new movie. We've been talking about that. That's the one that involves Worf and Bruce Willis and Annie all together in one movie, right?
Yes.
Is that where Daddy Warbucks comes back and says, "You think your planet is safe? It is not."
Yes, that sounds about right. But no, I've not actually picked up my tickets yet for the Best of Both Worlds event, although I did see a tweet about I want to make sure I get this correctly. It was an exclusive secret pre-sale of tickets for the Best of Both Worlds event that you had to be following at Star Trek to even know about.
Yeah, I saw something about that as well, but I don't know. I didn't go any further with it since I'm in Japan. Did you try to track down the secret?
I didn't track down the secret. Honestly, these don't really sell out. I mean, I'd recommend people buy their tickets in advance. Don't show up on April 25th trying to get in because there's a chance it'll be sold out. But they don't really. especially not this far in advance. So I figure I'm safe waiting till April at least before nailing down exactly what theater I want to go to. And you know, it still is only one time. We know this now, Thursday, April 25th at 7 p.m. Select theaters only, so you'll have to check the website, see what it is. I don't expect it will sell out, but it is this amazing, as we've talked about, feature-length cut of Best of Both Worlds. So instead of doing one episode, then transitioning into another episode after you've already been crying for a while, like happened with Measure of a Man, I was crying quite a bit at the end of that one. You know, you just do the whole thing, and then you'll just go home. It'll actually be really weird, because we don't usually see Star Trek without the regular commercial breaks. Even on DVD, it fades to black and then comes back.
Right. In addition to showing it, they're going to have the behind-the-scenes look. And I think they did this with the Season 2 event, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, it's Season 1 event, too. Yep. Yeah. They all had some special behind-the-scenes stuff.
Do they do that after the episode plays or before the episode plays?
You know, as I recall, there was a little bit before. And then between episodes, last time, they had a little bit about Measure of a Man. So okay. Before Measure of a Man, we jumped in. I would expect they're going to do behind the scenes of Best of Both Worlds first, then show us the episode, and then afterwards do a little promo about Season 4 and maybe some sort of a bit of the writer's roundtable, that sort of thing. But I'd expect most of the behind the scenes stuff to happen beforehand.
I see. All right. Yeah, I was just curious about that. Well, the reason we're talking about this is actually our first news story. We had an odd transition today.
Yes.
Fathom has a page up on their website, special page devoted just to this event that you can go to. And you can tap the screen right now if you're listening to the Enhanced, or go to the show notes page, or just go over to fathomevents.com. And you can actually look up to find out where this is showing closest to you. You can even buy your tickets if you want to pre-order through there. But, you know, if you're not in a city like Greg is in Seattle, where, you know, it's definitely a major city where it's going to be showing, you know, you can look up and find out what's the closest theater to you if you want to go check this out on April 25th. And I saw a poster over on TrekCore, and I don't know if this is an official poster they're going to put in the theater or not, because it looks kind of like it was hastily mocked up.
Hmm.
But it's basically the... very similar to the image of Picard that we've seen on the Blu-ray cover. It's very striking that the typesetting is really clumsy. So I feel like it was maybe just thrown together by an intern at Fathom or something. But
I'm sure they'll have a more official looking one.
Right. I think so.
You know, they don't do an awful lot of promotion of these things outside of just, you know, fan websites and the Twitter and the, you know, the main website. But I am seeing, you know, you go into the movie theater and there are ads on the wall, like where movie posters go, there's ads for Fathom Events. So it's possible that we'll see this poster or one similar leading up to April 25th. This is going to be a big push for Star Trek. We're going to talk about the game later. We've got the Blu-ray set. We've got this event. And then we've got the new movie. I feel like Paramount, CBS, going to really be both of them putting money into really promoting Star Trek, make people they're thinking about it and willing to spend the considerable amount of money that we'll be able to spend on Star Trek this year. They want to suck every bit of that out of us while we're thinking about it.
Yeah, there is a lot of money for us to spend on Star Trek this year. Just as we were talking in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
You're having to save up for that particular weekend, right? There's so much stuff.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, the month before, Enterprise is coming out. And then at this time, you know, we'll have the game, we'll have the Blu-ray, we'll have the Best of Both Worlds Blu-ray, and we'll have the movie event and, you know, popcorn and all that. It's going to be an expensive week of Star Trek. Absolutely worth it, but an expensive week.
Right. And don't forget all your Creo toys that you've got to buy as well.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Another thing that you need to buy, Greg, and I put this story in the rundown today because... when I saw these, my first thought was, boy, these would look great on Greg. These are the new Star Trek tunic tanks for women from WeLoveFine.com, made of cotton and spandex. Now, what do you think about these?
I do love a tunic tank, I must say. It's you know, tank tops. I guess tuna tanks have been, I don't know if they're still super stylish, but it was something that was quite popular for a while. You wear it over tights, you know, you wear it with, I don't wear it with a dress. I'm not stylish, or with a skirt. I'm not sure exactly what you, how you wear these, but it looks
although
kind
how
of
do,
like,
how do you yeah. wear yours, Craig?
Well, I, you know, I have my command robe, and then under it, I don't want to be completely, you know, so I just put on the t-shirt tank or the tank tunic underneath, making sure to match colors. You don't want to, you know, have your blue underneath and that's be wearing true. The command robe. So no, they're fancy. It looks like the scant uniform, but instead of a uniform, it's just a tight fitting cotton tank.
Yeah. All right. Well, I just had to throw this in because they just caught my eye, and I just had this vision of, because, you know, I did that mock-up of you in Encounter at Farpoint where you were
yes.
you were walking down the corridor of the Enterprise in your scant. So I was just, this is kind of like the TOS era version of that.
Right. Now at WeLoveFine.com, it appears they are currently sold out. I don't know if that's sold out forever or...
They're sold out for some sizes. If you click all the different sizes, they will tell you how many they have left. And
okay.
they are sold out of the smalls. I noticed that.
Okay.
It comes in small, medium, large, extra large for $29. So anyway, if you want to check this out, tap the screen or go over to the show notes page. We'll have a link. Go over to welovefine.com. And the way it was set up on the site was kind of odd. I think I actually had to search for Star Trek, and then it came up. It was not particularly easy to find, so check that out. All right, let's move on. Now, the next thing, we've talked about this definitely on Literary Treks, and I think we talked about it on here quite a while back as well, the Star Trek Visual Dictionary that's coming from Dorling Kindersling.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure if we ever actually have talked about it on this show in particular, but this is something that I'm absolutely really looking forward to. You know, something I loved as a kid, well, there were two things, but one of them was the Star Trek Encyclopedia. And it was just a database of so many things in Star Trek. And, you know, a lot of them had pictures along with it, which was really helpful. But, you know, it was black and white. Not everything had a picture. And with such a small area to put pictures, it wasn't that great. But another thing I loved as a kid was these visual dictionaries. You know, whether it was for, you know, battleships or for fighter planes, or I'm thinking of only things for the war, but I was interested in war as a kid. What can you say? I had a lot of these visual dictionaries from DK, and what they've done now is combine the two. So we've got a visual dictionary for Star Trek, and I am loving this idea.
Yeah, this one is looking absolutely fantastic. Interesting tidbit. I don't know if I've told you this before, but Isaac, who does all the illustration on Trek FM, all these, you know, aliens and such that you see on our site, he actually used to work for Dorling Kindersley in London, and he worked on the visual dictionary projects. So a lot of those books, Greg, that you read may had his hand in them. So,
oh, that's quite cool.
It's quite nice stuff. Of course, he's not there anymore, so he's not working on the Star Trek one, although that would be pretty awesome. There's been a lot of pages have come out showing different parts of the book recently. StarTrek.com got a few more the other day. What I'm particularly excited about here is a full 2-page spread of the Andorians, because when you can't get enough Andorian fight scenes in your episodes, so you definitely, when you open your book, you want to have them there too.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
You definitely do. Yes, I'm quite excited about the Andorians. I'm also excited, referencing a previous Ready Room episode, there does appear to be an entry for the prosthetic Spiner head, which always seems to turn up in odd places.
Well, you know, we've known that it existed. We didn't know all the details of it. And finally, with this book, you know, we're going to be able to talk about the prosthetic Spiner head much more intelligently on future episodes of The Ready Room, because I actually pre-ordered this book yesterday, so I am going to have it. And I went ahead and there's one nice thing about books as opposed to some of the Blu-rays. I can easily get them from Amazon Japan. And I have an option of which one I buy. So I actually bought the UK edition of this book instead of the US edition because it was slightly cheaper. And it also is going to be released on March 1st, as opposed to the US edition, which is released on March 18th.
Okay, so I have more money I can spend this spring on Star Trek. That's basically what you're telling me. Do we have an idea on pricing? Is it going to be, you know, in the $10 to $20 range?
Yeah. This one is surprisingly inexpensive, I think, because it is a hardcover book and it's 96 pages. And the list price is $20, but Amazon in the US has it for $10.87. So,
okay.
You know,
that sounds reasonable.
It's really cheap.
Yeah, I'll definitely pick this up. The one thing I am concerned about is the typesetting, because it does appear that inside the book, we do not have the curved E.
Oh, no.
And if you want to know more, go to trekfm.com/whatever. We have a whole article that Drew Stewart wrote for us about the curved E and how important it is. And while the cover of the book has the curved E, not inside.
Yeah, it's going to be a problem. You know, we need to make sure that we don't let Landru review this book for the site, because no matter how good the book is, he's going to trash it because the curved E is not there.
He'll have to go in with some whiteout, just some very delicate whiteout, make it a curved E each time, and then it'll be okay.
Yeah. So the parts of Star Trek that are covered in here are the 5 live-action series and the first 10 movies. So for those of you who hate J.J. Abrams, there's not going to be any of this Abrams-verse stuff contaminating your Star Trek visual dictionary. It's going to be the prime timeline, or as many of you call it, Star Trek.
It wouldn't surprise me if a J.J. edition comes out with just the stuff, you know, from the new movies. And they might wait and put that out later this year. And I'd be surprised if they don't do that. Although, of course, there's a lot more to do. You know, you've got to fill 96 pages. I don't know if there's that much from the JJ films, but it's easily enough. They're going to be missing a lot of stuff to even this, because they're covering so much, of Star Trek.
Yeah. I mean, this book could be, you know, 500, 600 pages to actually cover everything that we've had over the years. So I'm looking forward to this. You know, I also, while we're talking about these books, I also pre-ordered the Okuda's new Onboard the Enterprise D book yesterday.
Nice.
I told Matthew about it, and I told him that now I need to create little bitty characters so that I can walk them around the pop-up ship. And he said that might be going too far.
No.
No.
Don't be silly.
Come on.
I will be buying the little Hasbro Lego knockoff Enterprise with the little bridge set inside. I'm so excited about it. And I will be playing around with little characters and reenacting the movie. I'm going to have, you know, Spock attacking tiny little Kirk. Oh, it's going to be so much fun.
Well, I do hope that you're going to chronicle the adventures on Instagram.
I definitely will. Don't worry.
All right. So another thing we're looking forward to, Greg, is the video game that's coming out. We've both been playing Mass Effect a little bit recently, and there's a new trailer that's out for the video game, and it's sort of a making of trailer. I mean, it's only 2.5 minutes, so they don't go into great depth, but they reveal a little bit more of their thought process behind the creative decisions in the game. And in seeing that trailer, you know, I feel more and more like this is kind of a Mass Effect type game with Star Trek wrappings on it.
Yeah. One thing we didn't get a chance to talk about last week or the week before was a live chat that the developer of the game actually did just anybody could log in and ask them questions. I asked a couple questions. You know, one of them was about the Gorn, and they gave me a very good answer. You know, they knew that the Enterprise Gorn was different from the TOS Gorn, and they explained that, you know, it's sort of a mixture of the two, probably leaning towards the Enterprise Gorn just because it's more, you know, more dangerous, faster, but it's not quite as cheesy looking. You know, they put a lot of work into making sure it looked realistic and not quite as silly as the Enterprise one. So the fact that they knew, had that much knowledge about Star Trek to be able to give me an informed answer like that really, really impressed me. They seem to at least know the canon of the show. And That's at least the first place to start while making a game.
What do you think about the Gorn? Because in this trailer, we get to see a lot more of the Gorn than we've gotten to see in the previous trailers. And I don't know, at moments, I feel like they're fighting those little tiny velociraptors from Jurassic Park.
Yeah, yeah. Dinosaurs in spacesuits is the sense I was getting from it. And also zombies, apparently. Because there was a crewman with some sort of glowiness going on, and Spock took him down. I'm not sure what quite to make of it. I'm excited that they're going to New Vulcan. That's really cool because it seems like they're not going to be touching on New Vulcan in the new film, Into Darkness. So that they're doing that in the game. They're doing the Gorn. I think the Gorn make a good enemy for the game because, you know, you wouldn't want to try to do a tie-in with the movie. That always goes poorly. I mean, just remember, Enter the Matrix. This is bad times. So the fact they're doing an original story, pulling in an enemy that's dangerous and fast and scary like the Gorn, it makes me happy. You know, the question is going to be, what are the controls like? You know, is it fun to shoot the Gorn, or is it just going to be moving through these environments? It's pretty, but it's just not fun to play.
Did you see Spock mind melding with a Gorn in the trailer?
Oh, God. We need to... Oh, my goodness. We'll talk about mind melds later. I was not happy with Spock mind melding with the Gorn. I'm not happy when Spock does a mind meld when he didn't ask permission. It makes me uncomfortable. It makes me deeply uncomfortable.
Well, you talk about, you know, whether we just move around in these environments or not. And I like some of the answers that Brian Miller, who's the executive producer, gave during the trailer. But then he said one other thing that actually made me laugh, where he said, you get to be Captain Kirk. You get to walk around the Enterprise. You get to go to the bridge. You get to sit in the captain's chair and give orders to your crew. I was thinking, well, I hope we can go to the bridge. What kind of game would it be if we can't go to the bridge?
Well, I mean, of course there have been Star Trek games that came out where you couldn't go to the bridge, or, you know, a Star Wars game where you didn't get to go to the coolest environments. But the idea that you will be able to see, you know, the bridge, you'll be able to see the observation lounge, you'll be able to see, you know, turbolifts, walk around the ship, kind of like, you know, walking around the Normandy in Mass Effect. They talked a lot in this live chat that Mass Effect was one of their main inspirations. They wanted to make a Star Trek game right, so they looked at what games they were playing, what they were enjoying, and drew inspiration from that. So that makes me quite cool. You know, the trailer says you can be the Enterprise itself, which is really cool. Hopefully it won't be just a short little segment. Hopefully it's a good bit of the game where you get to fly around and really direct the ship.
I am the Enterprise.
Yes. Yes. Now, I'm really looking forward to doing the co-op. I love that they're approaching this as a co-op game. They've recognized that there's that Kirk-Spock thing going on in the JJ movies where they're really bonding. So to make it a co-op game and not just Kirk going for it, they're really pushing the co-op sections of it. That makes me excited too.
Right. Now, I understand if you pre-order, you can get a code for a special mode that allows you to do co-op as Keenzer.
I'm not sure if Keenzer is what you're able to do. There is. I did pre-order it either this week or last because I did want to lock in that. I think it's the Kobayashi Maru stuff, something or another.
Yeah.
So
and the special jackets or uniform. Yeah, I pre-ordered it.
Yeah.
As I mentioned on here back a couple of months ago.
Yeah. So that'll be. Now we know that's coming out, according to this trailer, the day after the Best of Both Worlds event, so April 26th, which is a Friday. Usually games come out in America on Tuesday, so I'm a little thrown off by that. It wouldn't surprise me if it gets pushed to Tuesday, but that's what they're going for right now. They're saying Friday, April 29th.
Okay, that's interesting because
or April 26th.
Somewhere I read that it's coming out April 23rd, but like you said, in the trailer and on the pre-order poster, they all say the 26th. Now, the 23rd would be a Tuesday.
It would be.
So I'm not sure which is... Maybe they're just pushing it to Friday. Maybe they're trying to kind of capture the whole Star Trek weekend experience with the movie event. So
yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a Star Trek trailer on the Best of Both Worlds event. So they're just doing a big push. You know, it's expensive to advertise this sort of thing. So they're going to want as many opportunities yeah. as possible to push it to
do
you.
Do that. Push people out the next day to go pick up the game. Yeah.
Yep.
Could do that. All right. Well, this looks it looks exciting. You can definitely tell that Mass Effect is an influence on the game, which I think is a good thing because it does look like we're going to get an actual really good, really fun Star Trek game. Oh, and the other thing is there's a lot of people jumping off of stuff in the trailer. So just like in the movie, in the game, you can jump off stuff also.
It's really important. I can't wait. I mean, Chris, you and I, we've already said we're going to do the co-op. We're going to try to play through the whole game together, I believe is our plan. So I can't wait. I mean, you jump, I jump. We'll do it.
All right, Greg. Well, let's take a moment and tell everyone about our sponsor, Squarespace. Now, each week we talk about different aspects of Squarespace, and we've talked about how you can use it to build a personal blog, or you can use it to build a large website like Trek FM. But this week, Greg, Squarespace launched a feature that I've been waiting on for a long time, and they say it's actually the most requested feature that they've gotten over the years from customers. And this is integrated commerce. They call it Squarespace Commerce. And have you ever tried to, you know, set up PayPal or, you know, any kind of process, or at least on the customer side?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many parts of this. You know, setting up store pages is hard. Like, let's say we just want to sell a Ready Room t-shirt. You know, it says, you know, it's just a picture of Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
And we just want to sell that. We'd have to set up a store page, and there's so much involved in that. You know, the we'd have to set up a shopping cart. We'd have to do the ordering and getting, you know, we'd have to hire somebody, you know, to put in the Visa information because we couldn't handle that ourselves. There's also a certification you need to do credit card transactions. So just trying to sell a t-shirt on our site, we'd have to go to somebody. I have tried to do it. It is not easy. And even using a site, you know, we don't want to necessarily talk about the competitors, but there's sites we've used before that I've used personally, and it was just a hassle. You know, they're charging you money. You're not sure what you're being charged for because you're locked into, you know, your store looks the same as everybody else's store. It's hard for people to get into your site through Google, and you just want it integrated with your website. I think that's the main thing everyone wants, is not a whole other site that you send people to, but just a store link on your site that looks like your site, works like your site. And that seems to be what Squarespace is bringing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, we've looked into it quite a bit, and there are different avenues that you can go. You know, there's, of course, everyone knows PayPal, there's Google Checkout, there are various others, but they're all kind of complicated. And, you know, we actually set up for ourselves a corporate PayPal. And that was quite a process,
yeah.
You know, so that we could bill people, we could do transactions as a business through PayPal. It was a multi-step process. It was actually quite complicated. But what they've done here is they've actually worked out an agreement with Stripe, which is a merchant processing system that allows you to accept credit card payments on your website. And the really awesome thing about it is that it's completely integrated. So, you know, there's no confusing codes to enter, and you can make your sales and the payments go directly into your bank account, which is a really big thing because some other systems make it kind of complicated for you to get your money out of the system into your bank account. So that's fantastic. And it's just like a 30-second merchant account setup with Stripe.
Stripe, I'm hearing wonderful things about. Friends of mine who are looking into doing their own stores, have been looking at, you know, do I want to use PayPal or Google or Stripe or one of these others? And Stripe seems to be the place to go right now. Yes, it doesn't let people use PayPal money to pay for things, but I think the number of people that actually want to do that nowadays is declining. So many people just want to use, you know, their Visa or MasterCard to pay for something. And Stripe is a fast sign up. It puts stuff right in your bank account. It's really easy. They don't hold your money because you're, you know, making too much money. All of a sudden, it's a really easy, just straight from the customer to you.
Yeah, that's the issue that we've run up against in terms of the terms that we've had to deal with some of the others. So this is a fantastic new feature of Squarespace. Very simple pricing. There are no transaction fees imposed by Squarespace themselves. And Stripe has very favorable terms as well, which actually better than what I've seen with other services. And this is part of Squarespace's new business plan. So we've told you before, their pricing is very simple, $8, $16 for unlimited. And now they have the business plan, which is $24 a month. And it gives you everything that you get with unlimited. Plus, it gives you this incredible new commerce platform. I'll give you just a quick rundown of some of the other features here. If you use MailChimp, which many of us do these days, your mailing list is integrated, so you can use that, you know, for your business and for your promotions. It has unified inventory management. You can put out coupons. It handles your taxes, your shipping. It has an order fulfillment interface and printable packing slips. You can export everything to CSV format if you need to use it in Excel or anywhere else. You get a store manager role. You know, we've talked before about all the different types of contributor roles on Squarespace. And it has automatic Google Analytics and mixed panel integration. And you can even import, if you already have a shop somewhere like on Shopify or Big Cartel, you can import that right over as well.
Yeah. So, we talked in the past about ways to monetize your site. You know, they have such good Amazon integration where you just, you know, just put in what product you want. It'll give you a little widget that goes right in your site. That's a great way to make money. But this is if you have a product to sell, really great. Get it direct to your customer. Don't send people to an outside site. Don't deal with all of that. You know, keep everyone in your team working in Squarespace, and it's going to be a lot easier.
Exactly. And of course, this is wonderful if you are running a large store. But even if you're just an artist, you know, and you design t-shirts like Greg was talking about earlier, t-shirts, you know, or posters or coffee mugs or anything, you just have a few small products that you want to sell. And you don't want to jump through all the hoops that are usually associated with online stores. Definitely give Squarespace a try. And I've actually seen this integration firsthand. It's right there. It's just another block, just like everything else. You can add a product. A fantastic addition to Squarespace. So give them a try. Go over to squarespace.com/trek. And they have a special offer for our listeners. You can use code TREK2 and you can get 10% off when you sign up. But you don't have to pay anything up front. You can try it all for free for 14 days. Have access to all the tools in Squarespace. Build your site. You can even import, actually, if you have a WordPress site on another platform, you can actually import that directly in and see exactly how it's going to look. Try it all out for the first 14 days and then sign up. And it's code TREK2, squarespace.com/trek.
Now, of course, we have the IDW solicits have finally come out for May. So, as we always have with comics, we know what's happening way, way, way in advance. So you can get super excited about something that you're not going to see for quite some time. But this time, it's simply ongoing number 21. But because it's May, that means this is a Post Into Darkness comic. So I guess this means everybody doesn't die at the end of the movie. So spoiler, sorry, someone at least survives.
Right, I guess so, because they're all on the cover, right? At least the cover mock-up that we've seen. Or maybe they're trying to throw us off, you know? It's just a mock-up cover number 21.
It's remembering, you know, remembering Kirk. Remembering Spock.
It's a memorial. The cover is a memorial of the entire crew. They're all dead. They're going to have all new crew members. It's going to open with a new captain, and they're going to be like all these torpedo casings and Federation flags.
Shooting them all out into space. Remember all those hugs with Uhura? Remember all those times Carl Urban scowled at you?
And then they come up to the new captain's face, and it's John Harrison.
Right. Oh, man. So, yes, this will be, I guess, late in the month. we have, you know, the new ongoing coming out this coming week, but I imagine they'll wait till the movie comes out. So it won't be the second week. It'll probably be the third or fourth week of May.
Yeah, it'll be after
we'll
the movie,
see this
of
comic.
Course. Yeah. 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 It did catch my eye when they said that it picks up right where this year's blockbuster sequel, Star Trek Into Darkness, leaves off. I like the fact that they're already calling it a blockbuster sequel. Apparently, they have been to the future. They have seen the box office return. No, I'm kidding. It's going to make a lot of money. So
oh, it certainly is. But I like that they're going, they're just going to go right on and keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know, they could have at least had a little block where they just kept doing, you know, maybe for the next 3 months, they kept doing these prequel comics where we find out more about the past of characters. But no, they're saying, we're going to spend a little bit of time. You're reading Countdown to Darkness for right before the movie. And then after the movie, go right back to ongoing. We're going to pick up where it leaves off. It's going to be sort of like a reboot for the comic at that point. That'll be really exciting to see. This is going to be, I mean, it's been a great comic for these first, you know, 17 issues we've had, 18 issues now. I can't wait to see where it's going to go after the movie.
It will be interesting. Yeah, for sure. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about those comics in just a moment. But before we do that, the other thing that's coming out in May is the Star Trek Classics Volume 4 Beginnings. So this is an omnibus that's actually a reprint of the DC Comics Next Generation series, issues 1 through 6.
Yes, it's a Next Generation comic, and I'm not sure when it's from, but these aren't new TNG comics, unfortunately.
Right.
As much as we'd love that, it's another reprint of a story. It appears to be a, you know, in the first season set storyline. It's about a Q who's not Q, but was depowered, and what happens with him. So it's sort of a mini arc in that TNG comic series. It'd be a cool thing to check out. You know, it's one of those cases of it's 152 pages, so it's the whole arc in one trade paperback. It's going to be $20. Sort of thing just to pick up if you never saw those comics before, and just pick it up when you're in the comic shop.
Right. And I guess it'll probably come out in digital as well. You know, often with types, they don't come out in digital immediately, but they come out, you know, a few months later. And then you can pick it up there as well if you prefer, like me, to read on the iPad, largely just because it's easier for me to get things that way.
Right, right. It's a little odd. They mentioned that you join Picard, Riker, Data, Worf, Troy, Yar, and LaForge. I guess there's no Crusher? There's neither Crusher?
I guess so. Yeah, the Crushers are on vacation.
That would be really convenient. Yes, yeah, so in the first comic, it's like, oh, it's too bad that Beverly and Wesley just got on the shuttlecraft because there's so many exciting things. Oh, hello, Mr. Depowered Q. How's it going? And the story's
right.
off.
Just a little passing remark about how Beverly and Wesley are gone. They just left the ship.
Yes. Well, that happens at the beginning of the Drumhead, I think. It's like, oh, it seems that director Jonathan Frakes isn't here right now, so let's not worry about that.
Right. All right, well, let's jump back to ongoing for a minute. Now, you and I have both had an opportunity to read ongoing number 18 and Countdown to Darkness number 2, which are coming out later this week. And 18 is the backstory of Uhura.
Yes.
What did you think about this one?
Yes, well, we didn't talk about the Bones comic on the show. I think you and Matthew talked about it on Literary Treks.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting story. It didn't get too much into his backstory, though. I mean, it was good. But this story was much more interesting to me because we don't know anything about Uhura. Like, at least with Bones, we had the, you know, what he said about having an ex-wife, and so we joined Starfleet. That was kind of all you need to know. And then it's like, well, that's all you need to know, but there's a little bit more to it. With Uhura, her background is such a cipher that it was really cool to get this story of basically a traumatic event from her childhood that I was really riveted during this one.
Yeah, they've done a lot with Uhura in the Abramsverse since the movie itself, because, you know, I was left with the 2009 movie feeling like Uhura was largely there just to run around and check on Spock and hug him.
Right.
I mean, we joke about the hugs, but seriously, I mean, Uhura's part in that movie was not particularly inspiring. But since that time in the comics, they have really given her this take care of herself attitude. You know, she's very tough. She jumps to action. And so far, what we've seen in the trailers for Into Darkness, it seems that she has that type of role in this upcoming movie as well. And in Ongoing 18 here, we actually do get some explanation as to why Uhura in the Abramsverse has that attitude.
Yeah, and that was really cool. The other thing that comes out of Space Adventure 2009 is the idea that Uhura was, you know, sleeping with the professor, that was kind of left muddled. Like, when did the relationship start? When did it... This makes it very clear, not to spoil things, you know, this is the beginning of the comic, but Uhura waits until she's done her final exam, it's all been graded, and then she asks Spock out. So she's very clear that she's not looking for favoritism, she's not having an illicit affair with Spock. It's all on the up and up, which I think is going to make a lot of Uhura fans and a lot of Spock fans really happy.
Right, yeah. But she does take charge.
Yes, she
does. She makes the first move on Spock.
She's the one who asks him out. You know, this Spock, I mean, even our Spock, the Prime Spock, I don't know when he'd be in the position to ask out someone. So I like the idea that Uhura makes the first move. And then they're both saying, you know, we didn't expect this to really be a thing that lasted, but apparently it is. So let's go with it. That's really cool. I like that part almost as much as I like when they go into the mind meld and into this flashback about her childhood.
Right. I think that the page 22, the big final panel, looks like it's going to be the cover art for some fanfic, I think.
Very possible, yes. I'm looking forward to seeing fan reactions about this one when it does hit this coming Wednesday. This one, if you haven't even been reading Ongoing, if you are an Uhura fan or you just want to know a little bit more going into the new movie, this is definitely a comic to pick up, almost more than the Bones comic from last week. Or from last month.
Yeah, it is. You know, they both were good. They both left me kind of wanting to know more, though. I felt like they were very quick. It's like, here's a quick little flash into the past of these characters. And I don't know. It'd be nice if they return somewhere down the road in Ongoing and give us a little bit more background.
We've got a lot of time, Chris, between Into Darkness and the third film. So I'm sure...
Probably like 5 or 6 years,
when they're scraping the bottom of the
barrel.
Yes, it'll be like, you know, from June until December of 2015 will just be Uhura storylines. And you'll know way more than you ever wanted to know about her teenage years.
Okay, well, that'll work. And we can watch her ponytail grow and grow and grow as the time goes by.
How did she get so good at hugs?
All will be revealed. All right, well, let's hit our last item in news today, and that's Countdown to Darkness number 2. And you sent me a message after you read it. You said, I have no idea what's going on in this comic.
No idea
at all. And then I read it, and I didn't feel quite as confused about it as you seem to be, but what were your impressions? It's definitely a middle story. It's definitely like that Empire Strikes Back. You know, or Search for Spock, kind of. It's in the middle of this story and you're thrown into it, and then when you leave it, you're still, everything's up in the air.
Yes. Well, I mean, I it's not a spoiler anymore to say that Captain April was revealed at the end of Countdown to Darkness number 1. So we go right from there. I'd say this one's definitely a page turner. I was every page, okay, what's gonna happen next? Have you finished reading? Okay. All right. What happened next? And every page had something crazy. Like, I mean, I don't want to get into too many spoilers for stuff, but like, okay, here's the Enterprise that was around before Kirk's Enterprise. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. And these aliens, they're having some sort of race war because they're different colors. Okay. And April's helping them. Okay. There's two specific things, Chris, that I see are in your notes that I noticed as well, and I don't want to say them on the show for spoiler reasons. I just I got to the point where there were so many elements being thrown at me that I did not know what to make of this comic. I don't know where it's going. I don't know what it's trying to say. It's really cool. I'm excited.
Yeah.
But I was left really baffled by a few of the references they made.
Yeah, there are two particular character twists that were very interesting. They're clearly setting stuff up for the movie, especially with those two particular ones. And one of them was very interesting to me because of the rumors about, you know, who the villain might be.
Yes.
Going way back, not recent ones, but like back when everyone was speculating on, is it Harry Mudd? Is it Trelane? Is it a Horda? Is it the Triple King? You know, is it the South Tolosian police officer?
Right.
back to that time.
Yeah, So I'm not sure entirely what to make of this one. I'm really excited for number three. You do seem to still be going with, you think this is the event that Pike is talking to Kirk about in the trailer.
I do think that that's it. And like you said, this particular comic, I mean, number two, it's not one that you can read number two and feel like you know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you have to take the ending of number one, take this one, and then no doubt take number three at least for number two to really make sense. So, you know, go and get number one, read it, get number two, read it, and then we'll all have to wait another month for number three to come out. But I do think that, you know, what Kirk has found himself in the middle of here, when it all plays out, I do think this is the event that Pike is talking to Kirk about in the trailer, when he's telling him that, you know, he's going to get everyone killed. And I mean, we know he's going to like have his command taken away, basically, right?
Right.
Maybe that's what we've heard.
And I'm not up in the air, because there's also that the scene we know about from the beginning of the film that was seen in the IMAX preview that could be what he's referencing. What I find really interesting is that we're talking a lot about the Prime Directive leading into this film. You know, not only in the IMAX preview, also in this comic, we're actually given a little snippet of April paraphrasing what is the Prime Directive. Like, we've never had it so specifically codified. So obviously the PD is going to be a huge, not the PDH, but the PD, it's going to be a huge element of this new Star Trek film. And I don't know why or what that means. So I'm really excited to see that.
Yeah, but that's the reason I think this is the event, is that there's so much about the Prime Directive here. Kirk's going to do something, and that's going to lead into the turmoil that we've seen.
Well, it still remains to be seen. We've got two more Into Darkness comics, and then the film.
Early in the first season of the original series, we got the first taste of Shakespeare in Star Trek in what is, I think, still one of the all-time great episodes of any Star Trek series, The Conscience of the King. We got William Shatner's Shakespearean training on full display in a great story. And today we're going to talk about this episode. And to help us do that, we have with us a guy who is for some reason wearing a face patch today. It's our TOS editor, Drew Stewart. Hello, Drew.
Yes, apparently in the future, if half of your face is blasted off, they just put a patch on it. There's
giant
really nothing
patch
else they can do.
Yeah. Those are made by Space Johnson & Johnson, I think.
Yes.
Sponsor of the fourth season of Star Trek.
Right.
And also we have with us a woman who's apparently running a drink bar tonight. It's our managing editor, Mistress Charlene Schmidt.
Hey, what else is new?
So, Char, you were just showing us in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
That you have not only your first drink, but you also have a cup of tea and a backup cup of tea.
Well, it takes a lot of work to do the ready room. And my first cup of tea is only half full. I know that's not going to get me through the hour, and I don't want to make like weird spit sounds into the microphone from a dry mouth. That's just really disgusting. There's a lot of YouTube videos out there of politicians doing that. Just take a look at the Republican response to the State of the Union address. You'll know what I'm talking about if you've seen that. It's gross. So,
yes, definitely.
Pervert this. I like to stay lubricated during the ready room.
I think we just lost Drew. But yes, this is, of course, why I have this tub of orange juice and then this champagne next to me, because I will be mixing mimosas on the fly as we go.
Excellent.
Stay lubricated, my friends.
I'm not always lubricated, but when I am, I make sure I am on the ready room.
We lost Greg. Wow, that's a new one.
Wow.
I love making Greg blush. It's great.
All right, let's go ahead and jump into the episode. And, you know, I have to say that it's been a long time. Of course, I've seen this episode many, many times over the years growing up with TOS, but I went back and I watched it actually 3 times.
Oh, wow.
Yesterday. So, because I really love this episode, and it amazes me that this is the 12th episode of Star Trek in the first season. The writing and the music and the performances are so good in this episode that it feels like they've been doing the show for a whole lot longer, but I think it was just the perfect material. You know, people talk about William Shatner and, oh, he's very cheesy and TOS is cheesy, but, you know, William Shatner was a Shakespearean trained actor, and it really shines in this episode.
Yeah, that was kind of the question I had, is did William Shatner just say, hey guys, can we just do a Shakespeare episode? Would you mind if we just did Macbeth on the show? And, you know, while they were just, you know, trying to figure out episodes, and they said, oh, sure, Bill, we'll do whatever you want. We'll try it out. And then that became, you know, much more of a common thing in Star Trek, is they did draw from Shakespeare. But as you say, this is the first time, and it's so overt. They actually had a Shakespearean, you know, they did Shakespeare there on the ship.
On the ship, yeah.
It's neat to see that even in the future, like, there's still traveling groups and stuff, and it's not everyone's a scientist or an explorer, that there are still actors. And not just, you know, oh, we're going to record it in a holodeck or whatever. I mean, we've got actors on stage with props, and
yeah,
it's neat to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, on a superficial level, that's what I like most about this episode, is we've got, like, I call them the Caridian Shakespeare Company Interstellar Tour 2266 or whatever it was. And that's fantastic. It is cool to know that something like this theoretically exists in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, it's more fun than seeing, you know, obviously we get Picard and Data in the holodeck and Patrick Stewart in a false nose and all of that. But it's more fun to see them on these, you know, these dinky little sets actually performing for the crew. It's great that, you know, as Kirk isn't telling anyone what's going on, he's just like, well, look, I just brought this, you know, troupe of actors with us. They're spending their time performing. Like, that's really cool. Like, when do we see actors on Star Trek? It's part of making this larger world. And I feel like because it was so early on in the show, they hadn't gotten locked in to, well, we've got to have a space battle. We've got to have Kirk punch somebody. We've got to have an Andorian fight.
I've been attacked by an Andorian.
This is early enough in the show that they could do a different kind of Star Trek. It's hopefully what Star Trek, the original series, could have been if it had gone on longer. But these early days, it's great to see what they were able to pull out.
You know, on The Next Generation, we see a couple of hints here and there that, you know, Beverly has people performing plays. But in the case of Beverly, it feels more like, you know, the crew, they're taking a class down at the community college in acting, and they kind of get together they do that. Whereas here, yeah, this is like a full-on professional theatrical group that is touring. You know,
yeah.
It opens on Planet Q, which I find is an interesting name.
The greatest name planet. Ever.
And then later, of course, they do the performance on the ship itself.
Yeah, right. And not only do they have a Shakespearean troupe, but the people themselves making Star Trek hired a guy who was a legitimate Shakespearean actor, a guy who taught Shakespeare in college for 20 years. You know, he looked the part. He knows Shakespeare. He's not just reciting the lines. This is one of those, you know, I wish they'd had more great guest stars. There's him, Ricardo Montalban, a couple others I can think of. But if you're going to do Shakespeare, I mean, really do it right. And they did.
Yeah,
they had to bring Arnold Boss in to play Caridian, to play off of William Shatner.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I mean, I know we see things like the Man Trap, you know, here at the beginning, and you don't realize that William Shatner actually is a great actor. And if you give him this material, his performance is going to be so strong that you're going to have to balance that with someone else who can pull this off equally well. So they did go after, like you said, their Arnold Boss and bring him in. And I thought Barbara Anderson as Lenore was also brilliant.
Yeah, of course, I own all six Lenore action figures because they made one for each costume change she made during the episode.
Do you have the variant that has the veil with the face hole that completely
the face hole veil? Yes, of course.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you, do these action figures vary in hairstyle as well? Like, does she have it all flipped over on the side? And then does she have it in braids? I mean, did they go into that much detail?
Absolutely. They really went all out in the 60s.
you know they did. Figures. On action figures.
The most interesting thing about that playset, though, was that each of those Lenore action figures had a little button on the back. And when you press it, it goes surging and throbbing, yet under control. Are you like that,
Captain? That's called feeling Kirk's vibe.
God. That entire scene where she comes to the bridge, like the entire thing is full of innuendo. I was just like, whoa, whoa, the whole time.
Every scene with her and Kirk is like that.
Yeah.
My favorite part of that scene on the bridge is where Lieutenant Rand comes onto the bridge. Yes. She gives Lenore such a look.
That was hilarious.
Turns out that was Grace Lee Whitney's final scene on the show.
Right, that was her final scene.
So that was
you're replacing me with her.
I was totally watching. I was like, oh man, she is so. She would rather be doing so many other things. And it turns out, yes, this was after they basically told her, Grace, you're not coming back. Maybe for the movie.
Yeah, she
in 20
knew.
Years. But no, you're done.
Yeah.
She knew she was. Yeah, this was her last scene, and it is like that. It's like she walks on the bridge, and not only is Kirk there with this other woman, and you know, I think Rand and Kirk were trying to have this kind of romantic tension between the two characters, but also Lenore being this blind, and here comes in Rand. So, oh, so you're just replacing me with another blind, are you? All right, then.
But yeah, exactly.
She looks a lot like
me.
Do
I have to wear a fur dress to impress you, Captain? Is that what I need? This was great. I like watching these episodes before the show with my wife because she always has interesting insights because she's not seen much TOS or anything and she likes to tease it. But she's like, can you imagine how hot a fur dress would be?
Mm. Oh my God.
Especially on like under the stage lights and stuff. I mean, like for the poor actress.
I will not make the joke I was going to make.
Well, that's a reality of doing theater. You know, I played in orchestra for 7 years, and that is hot. You're sitting up there in a tuxedo performing, you know, doing something like Wagner, something that's really demanding as a bass trombonist, and you have all these lights beating down on you, and you're just sweating up there. Yeah. It's just part of the job.
Well, that was a moment near the end of the episode, not to skip ahead, but just to mention, there's a moment where Caridian or Kodos is literally sweating bullets. And I was wondering, you know, is this the actor sweating under the lights in this, you know, 8 layers he's wearing? Or is the character himself actually sweating? Either way, it worked really well. The fact that his forehead was, it was just a flop sweat going on because he was being grilled.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the ideas in this episode. And one of them, which we get later on with Khan and going into DS9 as well, is this whole thing about eugenics and maybe, you know, choosing those who are worthy of continuing on and those who are maybe the weaker parts of society and should be weeded out. And kind of a central, the background behind this is that Kodos, when he was governor of Tarsus IV, killed half of the population in order to save the other half. You know, there are 8,000 people on the planet, and he massacred, is the word they use, I think, quite a lot in the episode, although they don't go into details, 4,000 people because there wasn't enough food and the food shipments are delayed. It's kind of a question to me whether, I think he felt very justified at the time of doing it, but I don't know, what were your thoughts on the whole eugenics angle here?
Yeah, well, I kept trying to figure out what, you know, what dictator they were trying to make him be. Like, is he Pol Pot? Is he, I mean, today, like Gaddafi? Is he Hitler? Like, exactly where are they going? And what I ended up by the end is maybe he's not even a dictator like that. He's just someone, well, the sense I was getting was like Gul Dukat, someone who's put in a bad situation, tries to make the best of it, but is making awful decisions left and right, infuriating everyone. And in the end,
yes,
he's not really redeemable. But at the time, he felt like he was doing the right thing.
Yes, that is exactly how I felt. I felt like he was put in the position where he had to make a decision, and he did. And it was a horrible decision, but it was his to make, and it was his to live with.
Yeah, I don't think that it was like a... I don't think he had it, I don't believe that the character became in power so that he could wipe out half the population.
Right.
Yeah.
Which a lot of dictators with the whole eugenics thing. I think maybe Spock is wrong in thinking that this had anything to do with eugenics. Yes, he did choose who lived and who died based on his own idea, but I don't think that he did that specifically to make the planet a better place. He did it so that some could survive.
He did it so they didn't have to resort to cannibalism.
Right.
Well, that's not a bad idea.
Which episode was it that I just watched Broken Bow, where Trip says, you know, who knows how far we'll regress, when T'Pol starts talking about their baser instincts.
That's right, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he makes the point that, you know, if the ship had arrived on time, he'd be regarded as a hero. I don't know if that's entirely true, but at least he felt that way. He felt that if he succeeded, people would be saying he made some tough choices, but he did what was necessary to make those that could survive, survive.
Yeah.
Now, my question, maybe you guys can explain it to me. I've never really understood it. How can only 7 people know what he looks like?
Well, they were the only survivors who had seen him, had seen his face, because Kirk was living on Tarsus IV. I think the timeline is that he had been stationed there right after finishing at the academy in this timeline. So he had been there and he had seen Kodos. But, you know, he goes to a lot of comparisons, you know, looking at the photos of them.
He looks at photos.
They have a photograph. Like, you don't need an eyewitness when you have a photo. It's like,
and there were clicking 4,000 people who survived. Like, it There's would like, be like, yeah. We've never met Obama, but if Obama wiped out half the population, you wouldn't be able to identify him because you're in Japan.
It's like there's cell phone pictures. There's like artist renditions. Like, we know what this guy looks like.
Not only do they have a photo of him, but it looks like they actually lined him up against a wall and they took a mugshot of him.
Right? They did.
Exactly. Yes.
Both young and old versions.
Well, you know, they went to the internet.
The same wall.
They went to the internet dictator database and pulled up the picture of him.
The IDB. Yes. Yes. IDDB.
The IDDB. And yes, I don't know. Spock at some point pulls up a picture of both of them. I feel like they're doing CSI, but then... No, we're still wondering. Kirk does it too. Kirk is looking at the pictures of both of them, and it's obviously the same guy. But Lenore has this idea that if she kills the 9, I mean, it's a cool idea, right? That if you kill the only people that know what he looked like, he'll be able to go free. But at the same time, everyone thinks he's dead, and no one's looking for him. And, right. And the right. only reason that face patch guy even saw Caridian, Kodos, is because they went to his planet to kill him. Like, if they had just stayed away from the Nine, there would have been no problem whatsoever.
And I like the chances that, you know, Riley is on the same ship. You know, like one of the two of the Nine people are on the Enterprise.
Coincidence?
Well, yeah. Hmm. Well, let me just about like whether he had ideas. He was sympathetic to the ideas of eugenics in a sense or not. Later in the episode, when Kirk goes in and he gives him the paper. So the actual speech, he says the revolution is successful. So he has been trying to carry out something on this Earth colony. And then he tells the people that he is sending to their execution. He says, but survival depends on drastic measures. Your continued existence represents a threat to the well-being of society. Your lives mean slow death to the more valued members of the colony. So he clearly is dividing people into groups of you're worthy of living and you're not worthy of living to carry forth the revolution.
I really loved his dramatic reading. Like, he could have just read it flat, but no, he wanted to really get his hand around that role. I was just waiting for at the end for you to put in the bum bum bum.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Bleep, bloop.
Just like when we read the Calcom press releases.
Yes, exactly. He did a really good reading, but it was sort of like a mini flashback, right? Like, it was him
right.
mm-hmm. remembering saying the words. It was Kirk exactly. remembering him say yeah. the words. Yeah. It was a wonderful moment.
It was really, really well performed.
I mean, this episode mm-hmm. took a little while to come together for me. You know, when it was, we'll talk about it in a second, but just Kirk, you know, doing the investigation by himself, where we don't know what's going on. Is this Kodos? Is it Caridian? The moment when these Shakespearean actors are in the room together and Kirk is confronting him with what he did, that's why, I mean, I think that's why Ronald Moore says this is his favorite episode of TOS. You know, he named the Astral Queen after the ship from this episode. I think it's this scene.
So say we all!
Because it's so powerful. It speaks to the complexity of your past. You know, your past isn't black and white. You can't just say, well, this event makes a man. You also can't say that the rest of his life makes it all okay. And it's all in this scene and in one other. Such powerful emotions at play. We don't expect it from TOS, this show we're so used to just giggling at. You know, look at that silly costume. Look at the, you know, the silly fight scene where Eddie Paskey shows up for no reason. This is powerful stuff.
It is. I mean, it's not that the ideas are not in TOS, but they rarely are pulled off as successfully as they are here, with as much gravity as they are here.
Right. And until this scene actually happens, I feel like the story is just kind of humdrum. And then this happens, and things really get set into motion, and it's very interesting. Because we learn, I think, a little bit about everybody's motivation. We kind of see what's going to happen. Or at least we see kind of how everything has been set up to this point. I don't know. I feel like we take a long time getting there. But once we're there, okay, now we're good, and we're going to have a really awesome time watching the rest of this episode, which we do. We see a lot of powerful stuff happen from here on out.
I don't know. I really like the investigation. I like Spock tracing Kirk's steps. I like him going to McCoy.
Okay, I'll give you that. I really love McCoy in this episode. He's fantastic with Spock. That's a lot of fun.
I just wish there'd been more reason for Kirk to be going on his own. Like, it makes sense in the Enterprise incident that it's a secret mission that he can't tell anybody about. In this case, you know, he can confide in Spock. Like, it would be fine for him to explain why they're suddenly bringing a troop of Shakespearean actors on board.
Yeah, it would. I kind of felt like he was starting his own investigation just sort of out of his own, maybe, like, morbid curiosity. Like, well, what if? But then he's starting to see things fall into place just a little too much. And so then maybe that's why he gets all secretive. I mean, that's kind of the theory that I came up with to make sense of that.
Maybe he just wanted to spend more time alone with Lenore. And if he had Spock by his side, if they were like, you know, like a Sherlock Watson kind of thing going on here, he wouldn't have been able to make out with Lenore as often as he did in this episode.
Can we touch on the fact that Lenore was 19 years old?
Yeah, I've heard people say that they're kind of bothered by the fact that Kirk is going after Lenore in this episode and she's 19. But come on, she may be 19 in the script. Barbara Anderson does not look remotely 19
right. In this
episode.
No.
On screen, there is absolutely nothing odd about what's going on at all.
Well, I mean, it's a little odd that Kirk is going after the daughter of a guy he thinks is a serial killer, a mass murderer.
Well, that's a question, actually, that I have. Of course he's attracted to her, I know, but as we get to the end, is he using her to get more information about Caridian?
Well, that's so much better that he's pretending to come on to her and kissing her and using her emotions just to get close to her to find out more about her father so he can... It feels like, the first half of a romantic comedy. Oh, yes, no. I mean, at the beginning it was just a bet and they this is just to impress my friends, but now I have real feelings about you. I'm serious.
But it feels like it's going both ways here because she's also... she knows that Kirk is one of those people, right, who could identify him.
Exactly. So it's almost like they're both... Thank you.
They're flirting continuously through the entire episode, but I feel that they're both going at each other for this ulterior motive.
Yeah, I feel like they're trying to figure each other out.
Yeah. It's not your straight Kirk sees some hot babe on the ship and is going after her situation.
Yeah. Well, this is why I see why you watch the episode three times, because it's the sort of episode where you pick up more and more on it every time you go. The twist is an impressive twist. Like, I'm trying to think of another episode that has such a twist, maybe the Enterprise incident, but that's still only like 10 minutes in and we find out what's going on. Here, it's the very end of the episode. Oh, he's not the killer. She's the killer. Bum, bum, bum. Right. And we realize that all of these moments between Lenore and Kirk have been about, it's not only Kirk doing it, Lenore, it's such a different story than we've been seeing. And it makes you replay the whole rest of the episode in your head.
Right, exactly. It changes everything.
I was surprised by the twist again.
Yeah.
When I watched it tonight, I just watched it a couple months ago and I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, because all the way through, the crew and the viewer, everyone thinks that Kodos himself is killing the people who can identify him. You never really realize that it's Lenore. Spoiler
alert.
For this episode. Yeah.
Well, unless you're a big Edgar Allan Poe fan and you're picking up on the fact that her name probably means something.
Right.
Right.
And it turns out she is.
Smart.
She's like every single crazy Shakespearean lady all rolled into one.
She really is.
Crazy. That insane laugh she has as they take her off stage at the very end, man. She's in hysterics.
Wasn't that a great performance, though, at the end when she like finally loses it? She's really insane
and it zooms in on her eyes. I mean, you can see the insanity brewing there.
Yeah. I feel like she was a Shakespeare robot that Kirk had just logic bombed, and she's just spouting different lines from different plays at random.
To be or not to be.
Wherefore art That's thou? Perfect. Wherefore art thou?
Error. Oh my god.
That's perfect. It was like that. It was. But I tell you, her performance all the way through, there's something odd about her speech, but it's very captivating at the same time, I found, throughout the episode. And when we talk about Star Trek and Shakespeare and plays, I do have to say that she's much, much better spoken than Barclay when he tries to do his plays on The Next Generation.
Yes.
A tad.
Okay, well, let's talk about the motivations of Kirk for a minute, because it is questioned whether he's after justice or whether he's after vengeance.
Yeah, like if someone says to him, you know, what are you just going to chop off his head and carry it through the street? And Kirk is like, well, maybe I'm not sure, actually. Like, he doesn't even understand, I think, what his motives are. He just knows he needs to get to the bottom of this. This is obviously something that's been bothering him for years. And, you know, the only piece he had about the Tarsus incident is he thought Kodos was dead. So bringing this up is obviously bringing up a swirl of emotions that he has no idea how to deal with. You know, if only he had Deanna Troi to talk with, I think this could all... okay, maybe not.
And then she would say, no. I'm sensing that he may be hiding something.
Yes. Yes. I sense that he's angry.
Is there really a difference? I mean, there is, but are there cases where justice and vengeance are the same? I can think of incidents, I'd rather not talk about them here, but I can think of incidents in my life where I would like to have vengeance, and I think that it would bring justice, but I know that it's wrong because it would be based on vengeance.
Right, so then you look for the logical reason to bring it all home, which mm-hmm. is, I think, what Kirk is doing here. He's trying to find beyond a reasonable doubt that what he believes is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that he can be justified in his...
Right, exactly, and he can put any other feelings he has about this whole thing behind him and say, no, look at this.
So he can have vengeance in his mind, but justice...
Mm. Right.
As a mass.
I think so.
Well, I think in general, we're seeing another way that Kirk is different from other captains. And I wonder if a lot of it isn't the time in which this is. Like, they were giving Starfleet captains a huge degree of autonomy at this time. Kirk kind of just was able to go patrol, go explore where he wanted. He never really... I mean, except in a few occasions, he never really got orders from the top to do something. So he wasn't really under an obligation to bring this to his superiors. Whereas I feel mm-hmm. like if Picard had come across a, you know, mass murdering dictator, he would have notified Starfleet Command and, you know, called a staff meeting. Whereas
yeah, absolutely.
Kirk takes much more of an autonomous approach to it. And I'm not sure what I think of it. I'm not sure if this is actually... the right actions for a Starfleet captain.
This is a case, I think, where Sisko is a lot like Kirk. Sisko oh, yeah. would have handled it on his own and not reported it to Starfleet.
I don't think Sisko would have spent so long looking at photographs. He would have been like, that's the guy! And he would have chased
yeah,
after
Sisko
him.
Sisko would have immediately tackled him.
Yes.
On stage.
Yes.
You're right, that is Kodos. Punch.
Yeah. Well, I did find it interesting here. I mean, as another DS9 comparison, you know, Odo, especially early Odo, would have just said, okay, yeah, those photos are pretty close, and this troop has been around when other people died. Yeah, let's go in airlock this guy.
Yeah.
But Kirk is, I mean, the investigation, even when you get to the end, he's just determined that he has to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Caridian is Kodos before he would take any kind of action. He says that to himself, like, I have to know.
Yeah, he definitely has so much that he doesn't want to act. And then that does show a lot of, you know, I think it speaks to Kirk's character that he doesn't just chase him down and tackle him on the mm-hmm. stage. I think it's taken a little far in the episode. You know, if I were cutting it down to 42 minutes for syndication, I'd maybe cut out some of that investigation, you know. There's the scenes. It's great scenes where he talks to the computer. This is the first appearance of Major Barrett as the computer, so it's fun for them to have these little scenes. But it's a bit much. Like, okay, computer, give me all the information about Riley. Now give me all the information about Kodos. Now give me all the information about Tarsus. It's like, okay, but this is stuff you know. This is stuff you can get to the audience much faster. But like I say, it's important for Kirk to really be doing his due diligence. I love the ending, where they don't even let it resolve. With Lenore killing him, it's Kirk doesn't really get his revenge because he's conflicted about whether or not Caridian Kodos is bad or not at this point. He doesn't get his justice. He doesn't get his vengeance. Nothing but bad things happen by the end of the episode. Other than, I guess, mm-hmm. Lenore gets taken into custody, but that wasn't something Kirk had ever thought to do. And at this point, he sort of kind of had feelings for her.
Right. And then they brainwashed her and she didn't remember anything anyway.
Right.
Right.
No, I think that was, she had a psychotic episode and she doesn't remember what she did. Like, she flipped personalities.
Oh, really? Well, you don't think they drugged her up?
No. I mean, like, at first glance, when I heard McCoy say she doesn't remember anything, I was just like, you washed her brain. But no, they didn't know matter or anything. I think that it was her insanity, because they also mentioned, she thinks he's still alive and he's touring places.
Well, there was,
I think,
more
she went back into her childhood.
Yeah, and there was more to that didn't make it into the episode. There was a scene at the end with her recuperating in sickbay after she had her nervous breakdown.
Oh, okay. Well, that would have been interesting. Yeah. I mainly just thought she was so ashamed at using a Windex bottle as an assassination tool.
She
just decided to forget all of it.
Got some Windex in my latte.
Can we talk about Riley for a minute? This whole Riley subplot. My favorite bit is that it was a completely different character, but then they cast Riley by accident. So they went ahead and just made it Riley again, which is just wonderful.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It was great.
Poor old Riley. He's kind of like the PDH of TOS here a little bit. Right?
Yeah,
poor guy.
And he gets the night shift. So we see Knight on the Enterprise. He's just sitting there at a console by himself while everyone else is in the lounge listening to her play the lyre.
And apparently there's no Spotify in the future, because he has to actually call the lounge and get Uhura to sing and play harp to him over
his
ship's PA system.
I hate it when I do that. It's like I'm bored at work. I have to call up Carly Rae Jepsen and be like, could you just do a quick... Do you call me maybe real quick? I'd really appreciate it. I'm so bored.
I know, I'm so bored. And then you want to eat. You've got your food there, and you want to have something to drink. And so you check to see if the drink might be underneath the lid on top of the food. And then you realize, oh no, there it is right there. There's the glass.
Right.
And then you look at it, and then you do the little thing, like you know that it's poisoned for dramatic effect. And then you just down the entire thing, and then you put it down, and then it fills itself back up so that you can spill it dramatically on the floor. It's impressive.
Yes.
Yeah. I like the chug zoom that they had there where they zoom in on you as you're chugging that latte down.
Yeah.
It's a fancy drink, but he was eating what appeared to be Play-Doh. So I'm not sure what Chef is up to these days. No, wait. So I guess it's not Chef at this point. They've upgraded to the food processors. So instead of getting like ribeye steak, like I just saw, I think last week on Broken Bow. No, now they're eating what appears to be colored Play-Doh for dinner.
Exactly.
It's nutritionally balanced.
Well, that's because, mm-hmm. budget cuts at the Academy. They shifted so much money to the fashion school because the admirals were demanding more and more out of their uniforms. They had to cut back the culinary training.
Yeah, it's really suffered at this point. You can tell.
Whatever. Like I kept telling my wife, this is the future. Why is she dressed like that? The future.
Yeah.
Why are they eating that? Future.
It's a future.
Yeah. I couldn't help but notice that Lenore was wearing sparkly tights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Know? With her fur dress.
We're in the
it
future.
Glorious.
Everybody wears sparkly tights.
Future.
They do.
Oh, so I have a question here. Speaking of all her costume changes, when they go outside on the planet and they're roaming around, now Lenore, is she actually killing everyone herself, or is she having some henchmen do it? Because if you're going to kill someone and dump their body out on the planet, do you want to take a stroll with your new boyfriend right past the dead body that right when he's about to kiss you, he sees the body?
Maybe you do. If you want to, if you're that good of an actress that you can just play it cool.
Yeah.
You don't want to avoid that spot. Oh, we don't want to go over there. Why don't we want to go over there? I don't know. I don't know why I don't want to go over there. But if you're just like, oh, look what happened. Oh, you found her. Oh. I think that it's actually more evil.
Okay, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And maybe she was like showing Kirk. Like not necessarily like, but like warning him maybe. To that he better watch out, because people are out to get him.
I'm just not sure what her grand plan is. Like, okay, you kill a couple people here and there, but then, okay, you kill the captain of a Federation starship, there's gonna be a real investigation. You know, Spock puts two and two together pretty quick, you know, finding out what...
Even in space.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Two and two is four.
Yeah, exactly.
If Riley and Kirk had been killed as well, they would have been looking into, okay, what are the similar things in their past? I really think Lenore would have been tracked down eventually, even if she had managed to kill the Nine.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like if you're just doing your homework on this kind of a investigation, you're gonna figure it out.
While we're on this topic, let's go ahead and talk about Lenore's motivations and why she's doing this. Because again, on a first viewing of this episode, you really don't realize that Lenore is behind any of this until the very, very end. Then when you rewatch it, you can, like we talked about earlier, kind of pick up the clues here and there. But when we get to the very, very end, then, you know, she's telling her father that she's doing it for him. She says, "I saved you," at the end. And interestingly, he's very unhappy because he saw his life after what happened on Tarsus IV as trying to protect his daughter and make sure that the sins of his past didn't affect her life. And then he's unaware of the fact that she's going around. And it wasn't just in this episode. You know, they talk about how these different people have died over the years, and every time this theatrical company was there. So she's been doing this for a long time, and he's unaware of it.
Yeah, like, when did she figure it out? When did she figure out, oh, my dad is Kodos? And then when did it go from... I mean, surely you've got to be horrified at first, right? Like, my dad is the guy that killed so many people. It's finding out that Darth Vader is your father. Like, you don't immediately go like, oh, maybe I should kill everyone who knows that.
It is your destiny.
Surely there's at least a couple yes. minutes of just being horrified about it.
I wonder if that's the ending. Like I said, her maybe regressing to a child after completing her task or accidentally killing her father. Maybe at the point where she found out, like another personality came in, you know, to help deal with the trauma, and that personality eventually took over and committed all these murders. And then when it was done, it killed itself. And then she reverted back to that state that she was in before.
So it's like United States of Terror. It's like, it's the only way she could deal with her father being Kodos was to allow this other personality to just take over. She's messed up. Maybe she needs Deanna Troi. Maybe that would... No. Probably not.
No. She is beyond Deanna Troi.
Most things are beyond Deanna Troi.
Let's make that very clear.
But what is her ultimate goal in killing everyone? You know, at the end, she tells her father that all the ghosts are dead. And I've buried them and there's no more blood on your hands. Like, she somehow, I guess, was in her own way... She's cleansing her father of the past.
Exactly. Yeah, I felt like she was trying to clean the slate for him because I think she sensed that he had at least some sort of remorse or guilt or something, some kind of self-torture for his past actions. And she's trying to eventually she'll show him, look, nobody else is going to remember this now. You can live your life free again. And let's go off. We're gonna play. We're gonna do plays, and life is gonna be free and happy and free of that guilt.
So she feels like she can erase the past, essentially.
That's kind of what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the idea that
there's 9 people total, right? That's not that many, really, if you think about it, for something like
this.
Well,
it's that old riddle. You know, if a tree falls in the forest, does it really make a sound? If the tree falls in the forest and then you kill all the people who heard it, did it ever really make a sound? I think
exactly.
That's her theory.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's kind of where she was going with this. If no one is there to recall, then nobody is ever going to really theoretically figure it out unless they're digging through files like Spock was.
Yeah. That's kind of, you know, the justification that Anorax has for what he does on Voyager in Europe Hill as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody's there to remember it. So be it.
Well, after she says this to her dad, he says, "You've left me with nothing." So the other topic I wanted to talk about is Kodos/Caridian and whether he feels remorse over what he did in the past and the fact that he has chosen to create this theatrical group where he actually relives these murders over and over and over on the stage. Is it sort of a form of self-punishment for him? What does the feeling and the remorse mean to him?
Yeah, self-torture. Maybe it's some weird, twisted way of coping with what he's done.
Right.
What I took from it is a lot of the same thing that Drew was saying with Lenore, where she let another personality take over. I think Kodos wanted to give himself other parts to play. That, you know, he had played what he feels was this evil part for so long, or this part he feels bad about. Maybe if he becomes someone new, he's playing a new character. He's this new person that will erase his past. So he's dealing with it in it's kind of similar way that Lenore is. The reliving it is an interesting thing that I don't know that I thought about, where he is playing an evil character on stage as well, or at least someone who's killing. Maybe that is something of a punishment.
You think it's an outlet for him to maybe self-torture, but then also deal with his grief that he has about what he's done?
Oh, well, yeah, I think so. But if you look at, like, at the beginning and the opening scene, he's holding the knife. And if you look at the expression, the feeling he has, I feel like at that moment he's remembering, he's reliving the executions. I mean, I know he ordered people to be executed. I don't think he was actually going around stabbing 4,000 people with a knife himself personally. But
no.
But the memory's there, you know, and it's still blood on his hands, and he's reliving that and doing it over and over and over as they perform this play.
I agree.
I definitely need to watch this episode over again. You know, I like Drew, I'd seen the episode in the past few months when I did a bit of a TOS rewatch, at least watched the entire first season. So I know I saw this, but looking at episodes to do this week, I just looked at the description and it was, you know, Kirk suspects a member of an acting troupe to have been a mass murderer. I was like, oh, this is going to be wacky. I thought this would be a wacky, silly episode, a fun time to be had by all. But instead we get this really deep reach into a man's psyche. I just need to watch it again and try to get my mind around all these, well, at least Lenore and Caridian Kodos. What was he really going for? How much was he just lying to himself, or lying, at least, was he just lying to Kirk when he says, well, perhaps that was, you know, a part I played? Like, is that something he actually believes? Is it possible to get yourself to a point where you believe that events you did were in fact performed by someone else?
Yeah, very good point.
A lot of things, a lot of questions we don't know.
Yeah. I've got to admit, the very first time I watched this episode, I did not get it. I think I was too young and it was far too deep for me to understand all the layers that were going on here.
Yeah.
It took, I don't know how many viewings, honestly, until I really understood the scope of it. Because at first I thought, this is a really bad mystery.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, in that sense, it is a bad mystery, right? Because we all pretty much know from the beginning that Caridian is Kodos. There is no mystery.
If he wasn't, it'd be a really silly episode.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the worst thing you can do in a mystery is reveal the culprit in the very beginning. So I thought, what are they doing here? This is dumb.
Although, as we've said, there is a great mystery that you completely miss the first time until the very end, that Lenore is the person who's killing
everyone. Right.
Right.
It's so much...
Yeah, until you grab onto that.
Yeah, it's so much more of an interesting episode. You know, I watched half last night than half today, And after the first half, I was still even like, oh, this is just a goofy episode. After I finished it, I'm legitimately, after, you know, so much reflection for the show, I'm putting this, you know, in my top five TOS. You know, this is a really good episode. As much as it has that traditional TOS silliness to it, it's a lot deeper than you're expecting from any TV, honestly. This is up there, as I say, with the best of DS9.
And sometimes you have to stop and think about TV in the 60s. I mean, no other show was going to talk about issues like this. I mean, this was how people in the 60s got these things introduced to them. Unless they were watching the news. I mean, Bonanza is not going to cover, you know, God, I hope not.
Very unlikely Bonanza is going to cover the possibility of somebody having multiple personalities.
Guy killed half of his cows to save the other half of his cows, maybe.
Right.
Yeah, no.
Because there wasn't enough feed available.
Now he's murdering all the other cows who can recognize him.
The grass was dying in the pasture. There wasn't enough grass for all the cows. No, it's a good point. And Greg, you mentioned much earlier in the discussion that this is an example of what maybe TOS could have been if it had, you know, continued on. But I think these are the kind of stories that I think Gene Roddenberry really wanted to do more consistently. But we know it was really hard to get this type of stuff. You know what happened with The Cage, and it was too cerebral, so they had to go back and make another pilot. So you're going to get a lot of things more like The Man Trap or Operation Annihilate or other things like that. I think it would be hard for them to do stories like this consistently at this point in time on television.
Yeah.
So they had to sprinkle them around. You know, and you get this, and you get The City on the Edge of Forever later in the season.
Well, it's like they had just made Miri, and then they make this. Like, did the production team understand what a completely different show this was than what they had just made last week? Like, surely they must have understood, and they felt bad about having to put in these filler episodes.
Probably.
Yeah,
I'm sure
they had to slip this in.
Yeah, I'm sure the writers and Gene would have preferred to do stuff like this more consistently. But at least we have this one. You know, I was thinking, actually, tell me what you guys think about this, that if you think about Star Trek, all the series and all the seasons, I still feel like maybe the first season of TOS is the deepest, consistently strong season of all the seasons of Star Trek.
I put it up there with Enterprise season one. I think it's consistently very strong. But yes, TOS has probably the most consistent, certainly the most consistent first season. I'm sure there's people who would argue something like DS9 fourth season is kind of fantastic beginning to end.
I don't know. I'm in the middle of the fourth season right now, and you know, starting off with that, you know, Jake Sisko is 1,000 years old now episode didn't start it very strong.
Are you talking about The Visitor?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You don't like The Visitor? All right.
I didn't care for Visitor.
Get off the show.
People are very divided on The Visitor. I think you'll like it better more times you watch it. It's an odd one though. It's hard to deal with it. But it's like this. Like, it's a little different than you're used to. And sometimes it takes just getting on board with the show, figuring out what this episode is really about. Sure, we say that about Conscience of the King, but then there's Miri and there's The Man Trap. And what are these episodes doing in my Balance of Terror, in my City on the Edge of Forever? You know, how is the same production team, the same actors doing both of these at the same time?
That's a really good question.
To them, it was just a TV show. I mean,
that's true.
They didn't realize what they were doing. They didn't figure in 5 years anybody would care what they'd done, let alone here it is almost 50 years later.
Yeah, it was a completely new thing. You know, I sometimes say that by the time you get to the end of Voyager, the whole Star Trek, it feels so formulaic. It's like, this is how we make an episode. And it's almost like a cookie cutter. Dun, 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 dun. There's a Star Trek episode. But here,
almost.
It's like, it's a new frontier and they're just making this stuff up. And there's this tug of war between the philosophical and the creative side and then what the studio wants and what's going to get ratings on television, which we still got that tug of war, especially on Enterprise. We got that. But here, I think, yeah, that's why there's so much inconsistency. But as a whole, and there are, what, I believe 29 episodes in season one of TOS, which is something that was never done again, probably for good, for the better of storytelling. But there are enough gems in season one that it's really stacked.
Oh, yeah. I mean, season one is clearly a solid season. You know, if I was only going to own one season of TOS, it would be this one. It has some of the best episodes of Star Trek, and I'm more than happy to put this one in that list.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, season one is the only season I have on DVD of the original series. I've meant to get the others, but, you know, I bought it way back in 2004 when it first came out. I was a poor college student and saw that I think maybe half.com or something had a deal. And okay, which season should I get? I can get one. Ultimately, I went with season one. It's got City on the Edge of Forever. It's got Space Seed. I think I made the right choice.
All right. Well, why don't we wrap up our discussion with some final thoughts? Landru, how about you kick us off? What are your final thoughts on The Conscience of the King?
Well, when it was brought up the other day as this week's episode, I thought like Greg. I was just like, oh, yeah, you know, when you run out of ideas, you might as well just quote Shakespeare for half the episode. It's public domain. But then on watching it again, you really see the depths that it was going through and the stories it was trying to tell without telling it and trying to have the moral without, you know, spelling it out for the audience. And I really like it, and I think I'll give it 6 out of 7 people who recognize the face of Kodos.
The other ones are dead, right?
Right.
Chris, I think you really hit the nail on the head when you said a moment ago about, you know, this being not by the books Star Trek. You know, my takeaway is Star Trek really can do a lot of different things, and even TOS can. You know, this is an episode that doesn't do any bridge scenes for quite some time, doesn't even really have any character other than Kirk for quite some time. It's so much an investigation. It's getting into Kirk's head. It ends differently than you're going to expect. It's an example of what a freeing concept Star Trek is for television. And it pains me, you know, when Star Trek forgets that. And this is an episode that remembers we can do an episode about our main character hunting down a mass murderer who is now in an acting troupe. Like, that's not a concept you could do on Gunsmoke. That's just, you know, they're not doing that one on the stage next door. That's only a show Star Trek can do. And I just loved it. You know, I'm definitely going to give this episode 10 out of 10 costume changes.
Nice. Yeah, I had forgotten just how good this episode is. I probably hadn't seen it in a good 9, maybe 10 years. So I rewatched it starting this morning and then ended up having to watch it a second time just because there was so much to see in here. And I thought, this is really freaking good. Like, when you have to actually pause and then watch again, you know you've got something very intricate, very thought-provoking. And of course, it's very superbly acted as well. So this is going to get 9 glasses of milk from me.
Excellent. Yeah, I really appreciate the layers in the writing here because, you know, I watched this episode as a kid. I can remember watching this episode in high school when I used to have all the original series episodes on VHS tape bought from the bookstore. And you can watch it straight and it can be this kind of, as we've described it, bad mystery where we already know who Caridian is at the end. And you can watch it that way, but then you can watch it over and over and over and you can see more and more and more in it. And so the depth of the writing and the layers here are fantastic. I really love seeing William Shatner being given material that shows his acting chops off. So he's not just the silly, you know, mutiny spin in the corridor and, you know, falling down, screaming with grabbing his head like we see so often. But you can see his training shine here. And I think if anyone tells you that, you know, I can't watch TOS, it's too cheesy, and William Shatner is terrible, and tell them to go watch this episode, and then ask them to tell you that TOS is not good, and there's not good storytelling here. Just really, really fantastic episode. I'm going to give this one 10 squirts of Windex. All right, well, we have a full Trek FM crew, but anyway, Landru, go ahead and tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
They can find me on Twitter at 005, and they can find me on the Observation Lounge most of the time with our good friend, Greg Harbin.
Where you are not co-host.
I am not co-host.
Not at all, Drew, and don't you forget it.
I am not forgetting my not co-host.
All right. How about you, Char?
Well, you can find me on To the Journey.
To the Journey.
To the Journey.
You guys are so tardy with that. Come on. Get with it. Where I am a co-host with Lori and Tristan, and we discuss Voyager every week. And then, of course, you can find me on Twitter as well, and my handle is Oh the Profanity.
As I was saying on the other side of the room, Chris, I've been wanting to do like a serious discussion of TOS. You know, take one of those really hard-hitting TOS episodes and do, you know, we're an episode where we're not just, you know, making jokes about Andorian fight scenes and, you know, scants and funny stuff, but really delve into it. Honestly, I wasn't expecting this to be the week, you know. reading the description of this one, not remembering exactly what happened in the episode, I sort of picked it thinking it would be a good discussion, but what we ended up talking about is exactly what I've been trying to do. I thought we had a great time this week.
Yeah, we did, and I felt going in that this would be the one because of the internal explorations in this story into the minds of not only Kirk but Kodos and Lenore. And you're right. I mean, we do tend on here when we do TOS, we tend to do really light episodes and we joke around a lot. I think it's because we get really heavy on DS9 mm-hmm. and we get really heavy on Enterprise. And then when we come back to TOS, we're ready to kind of take a breath and relax a little bit. But in reality, you know, I grew up with TOS and it's the reason that I came to love Star Trek, and it's the reason that I love Star Trek for its exploration of social issues, because even when they're not pulled off as well as they are in terms of performance as they are in The Conscience of the King, TOS is full of deep ideas.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad, like you said, that finally on here, we got around to really talking about that.
Absolutely. I can definitely see Ronald Moore, Ira Stephen Baer saw this episode and said, we can do stories like that on DS9. And I can think of a lot of TOS episodes where I see the inspiration for Voyager and a lot of it the inspiration for TNG and even some of it the inspiration for Enterprise. I didn't think I could find the seeds of DS9 in TOS, but in Conscience of the King, here it is.
It is. All right. Well, Greg, let's tell people where they can find us if they'd like to share their thoughts on The Conscience of the King or anything else we talked about today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show, send to the Ready Room. That'll come to Greg and me. You can also find us in the new forums at trek.fm/forums. There is a section just for the Ready Room if you want to talk about this show. And there are sections for TOS as well. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. We have a very rapidly growing community there. And we've got quite a few new little games and activities for you to play there as well. So definitely check us out. And you'll find us on Twitter under username TrekFM, where the four of us who were on the show today all tweet from that account. Greg, what if people want to find you?
Well, first of all, on the TrekFM network, please do check out my other show, The Observation Lounge. As Drew mentioned, I have him on and usually also Catherine Bryan, and then a mysterious fourth guest will usually appear, where we step out of the Ready Room, off the bridge, out of 10 forward, not anywhere near deck 8. We step into the observation lounge, and we talk about the week in non-Star Trek-ness. As much as I love Star Trek, it's fun to talk about other geeky things from a Trekkie's perspective. So check out that show, please. And also check me out on Twitter, where I'm there at Greg Harbin. That's GregHarbin.
And if you want to find me on the network, in addition to the show, you can find me with Matthew Rushing on The Orb, where we talk very deeply about Deep Space Nine every week, and on Literary Treks, where we talk about books and comics. And then I have my occasional interview show, Matter Stream, as well. And you can find me on Twitter under username C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much anywhere in social media under that same name. Let's also give a big thanks, Greg, to our sponsor, Squarespace. We want to encourage everyone to go check them out. You'll absolutely love the platform and the service. Go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK2 to save 10%, and you'll be helping us bring these shows to you and supporting our sponsor at the same time. Well, Greg, it's time for me to go. I'm going to wander down to sickbay and have a drink with Dr. McCoy.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a bloody dagger in it, because the Ready Room is done. 4,000 denotages for tonight will justice, tonight will justice, tonight will justice be restored. Daughter, daughter, I was a soldier. Things had to be done. Murder, flight, suicide, and madness. I never won.